schedule this week, we have Senate Bill number 56 that's on the annuity. That will be heard on Monday at 1:30, so if there's anybody here for Senate Bill 56, that's on Monday. The other second announcement I have is that this is my sixth year at selling Girl Scout cookies. They're available as you walk out. They're $2.50 a box, so for Southeast Girl Scouts, I'm doing
it. Mr. Chairman, can I have equal time for daffodils at $3 a box?
But I'd like to invite Vince Wright and also Chuck Logson up here. We're going to listen to the forecast that's been presented. Is the commissioner also here? But one of the announcements that you've heard also is on the Senate side, they have adopted a number of $15 per barrel. One of the things that both the Senate, House, and the administration needs to do is basically adopt a number between the three of us. We can play with these numbers and grasp any number we'd like to. If the administration comes in at $4.58 per barrel on their forecast, the Senate comes in at 15, the House can also grasp a number that they seem to go. But I'd like the administration to go through how they arrived at a price, if there's going to be a shortfall, and what funds that you plan to take the money from. I'd invite either you to make your presentation, and also, please, for the record, state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Charles Logston. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue. Our presentation today is going to take a little different form than it has in the past. As you know, we have adopted a scenario approach to developing the oil price scenarios, and what I will do for you is basically, as the chairman has outlined, go through the scenario development and provide you with some views that we have in the Department of Revenue with respect to the future for oil prices and what some of the fundamentals are. First, let me begin, though, first by just very quickly going through the three scenarios. We have a high-price scenario, a mid-price, and a low-price scenario, and there would be a different level of unrestricted revenues associated with each scenario. I guess maybe the easiest way would be to start with scenario number one. It is on page 3 of the handout, which is a memo to the governor from the commissioner. Scenario one, the total unrestricted estimate for FY88 is $2.0851 billion. In 89, $1.3376 billion, and 90, $1.2851 billion. These are fairly low revenues, as you might noticed. But let me go through quickly for you the rationale for the price assumptions which underlie this. The first one is that we would be looking at slow world economic growth over the next 2 years in the range of 1 to 1.5% per year. Number two, because of the investments made in recent years to develop new fields, non-OPEC production is assumed to average 500,000 barrels per day higher in both 88 and 89. Number three, we assume the Iran-Iraq war continues to rage and starts in fits with no material impact on shipments of oil from the Persian Gulf. Iran output will be constrained to 2 million barrels a day, while Iraq will produce 3 million barrels per day. Number four, as a result of the first three assumptions, we're assuming that OPEC will be looking at a market share which will range somewhere between 17.5 and 17.7 million barrels per day in both 88 and 89. Unfortunately for price, OPEC producers will wish to sell up to 18.8 million barrels per day. The result of this disparity between the assumed market share and the desire to produce, we will see prices falling to essentially the low end of the range over which the market has cleared over the past 2 years. The low, I guess, would be $10. We're actually assuming that that low range will be, as you can see from the numbers up at the right under the scenario heading, somewhere right around $12 a barrel for ANS at the U.S. Gulf. Well, let's briefly turn now then to the mid scenario on page 4. This scenario, in terms of price, we're looking at a West Coast 88 price coming in, average for the year 1482, Gulf Coast 1586 for a weighted average of 1524. For 89, we're looking at 1417 West, 1519 Gulf for an average lower 48 of 1458. Well, I did forget to mention the revenues associated with these prices, but that would give you in fiscal 88 $2.11 billion and in FY89 $1.772 billion, and in FY90, 1.825. Essentially, the scenario was based on modest world economic growth in the range of 2 to 2.5%, non-OPEC production increasing on average 500,000 barrels per day, both in 88 and 89, also due to investments made in years prior, when I guess the expectation was probably more specifically for $18 to $20 oil. Number three, the Iran-Iraq war continues to rage on with no major impact on the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. This implies an OPEC market share somewhere between 17.8 and 18 million barrels per day in both 88 and 89. OPEC behavior can be characterized as a cycle. OPEC tightens production discipline at the upcoming meeting by allowing Iran to produce outside an official quota, while Iraq trims their production to 2.3 million barrels per day. This, plus strengthening prices due to a seasonal increase in demand, pushes OPEC production up to 20 million barrels per day, which creates seasonal inventory accumulations, which historically become a problem in the spring when no single producer or group of producers are willing to curtail production below quota to meet the changes in the seasonal demand pattern. This cyclical pattern, I guess, is pretty much based on what we have seen occurring over the last number of years. Price will therefore swing within the consensus range, according to the this OPEC cycle. And by the consensus range, we're using the boundaries of the playing field analogy of Stanislaw, which would be anywhere between $12 and $20 a barrel. The high scenario on page 5, unrestricted estimates for FY88, $2.156 billion, FY89, $2.3168, and fiscal 90, $2.4 billion. Without going through the prices, I guess if you look at the table, you see that basically this could be characterized as $19 oil in the U.S. Gulf or $18.50 lower 48 average. The high price scenario assumes strong world economic growth, 4% per year, non-OPEC production increase of 500,000 barrels per day this year, but no additional production in 89. That would be either as a result of less investment in production or some sort of voluntary restraint in non-OPEC production. Three, the Iran-Iraq war continues. However, the combined production of both countries does not exceed 5 million barrels per day. Number four, this implies an OPEC market share of 18 to 18.2 million barrels per day in 88 and 18.7 million per day in 89. OPEC sticks to a realistic quota of between 17.8 and 18 million. With key discretionary producers observing seasonal quotas. This would result, we feel, in oil prices, which would remain relatively stable, close to the current official OPEC fixed price, which on a market basket basis is around 18, although you see this is roughly a dollar a barrel higher than that even. Well, let me just make a few comments about what we see right now happening in the market from our perspective. This isn't the first time that we've come before this committee with a mid-case of around $15 a barrel. If you recall, last year, our March forecast suggested that the mean price to expect for Gulf Coast ANS was $15.16 in 88 and $16 in FY89. I guess with a little perspective, maybe we were wrong, I guess, about the rebound that occurred last summer, but I would say that the consensus that is developing now, which I guess is evidenced by the Stanislaw, recent Stanislaw Cambridge Energy Research Associates forecast, which apparently the Senate is looking at, has come around to the $15 oil level that we were assuming long ago as last spring. I guess if we had, with the benefit of hindsight, I guess we might have taken what the Department of Revenue was saying about $15 oil and the futures market was saying last summer of 18 and asked ourselves, well, what if the Department of Revenue is right and we might have gotten into the futures market at that time. Unfortunately, we don't have that option now. I mean, we can buy in the futures market or sell, I should say, as much $14 or $15 oil as we want. So anyway, that is a little bit of a sidelight. Let me make some comments on a very short-term market as we see it. Well, first of all, before turning to the very short run, let me talk about the good news, which is more of a medium-term thing, and that is that the consensus in amongst oil watchers seems to be developing around this $15 oil price. And if that occurs, that's going to trigger a lot of things in the real world, which may lead to higher prices later on. And the things that we're thinking about are companies will begin to invest less in development and exploration and begin to invest more of their money in downstream investments, refineries, retail distribution outlets, consolidation of the oil industry in the private sector, as well as the companies or the oil producing countries buying into the companies, companies buying oil reserves rather than exploring and developing them. The implication is that we may see non-OPEC production begin to decline significantly, putting OPEC back into the driver's seat so that they would be able to sell what they perceive as their market share without adversely affecting the price. The bad news, however, is short run. There is some bad news, and there are a few things that we are watching that are of some concern to us. One of them is that there appears to be some lower than normal seasonal destocking of inventories. Estimates were that inventories would be drawn down in the first quarter roughly 2 million barrels a day. It appears that that is only about 1 million barrels a day. The reason this is potentially bad news is that it suggests that people are buying a lot of oil because they think the price is low, and it's a good idea to buy oil now because the price is low, with the result that the springtime, or I should say the third quarter expansion in demand that we've seen in the last few years, which has led to this cycle, price goes up in the fall as OPEC production follows the market up, we may not see as high a rebound as we've seen in the past. The other real problem that we're continuing to see is the fact that Saudi Arabia and other countries which are very much big producers within OPEC are actually offering open market discounts, and of course it makes the official price structure of 18 look even less real if there's no oil sold at that price. Just a couple other comments. If you're interested in what some other current forecasts are, Cambridge Energy Research Associates is looking at $15 oil. The legislature in the state of Louisiana recently adopted $16 a barrel as their price of oil that they would use for their revenue forecast. You should understand, however, that Louisiana oil is quite a bit higher quality than Alaska oil. A $16 price for Louisiana oil may translate into an ANS price as low as $14.50. Exxon is announced that they're using $18. They're continuing to use $18 oil for their five-year forecast. Those are just to give you a couple of ideas of what other entities are using for oil forecasts. Let me conclude by saying that any forecast right now that's around $15 a barrel, plus or minus a dollar for the next 2 years, is probably consensus. Which means that our mid-case basically falls right smack dab into the middle of the consensus. The problem, of course, is that there is extreme volatility associated with any oil price that you would wish to assume, because oil, frankly, right now is a very much a commodity, and its price is very much influenced by not only real but psychological factors. A simple wave of the hand by King Fahd of Saudi Arabia can move the market 50 cents on any given day. So it's an extremely volatile commodity. And finally, I think the bottom line is that given that OPEC behavior currently, which seems to be we want a given market share at any cost, suggests that low prices are probably more likely than higher prices. That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman. I would entertain questions at this time.
Mr. Wright, did you have anything to add, please?
No, sir, I don't.
Thank you. Representative Larson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a real general question. I noticed in all three of your scenarios, you included the criteria of the Iraq-Iran war continuing. What would be the impact if that war was to come to a successful end, say in a draw, or one side or the other winning?
Okay, well, there's two answers to that. One is that price would go up, and the other is that price would go down. if the two countries were not at war, it might help OPEC pull together and cooperate, since there would be a minimizing of the conflict between members. And that would lead then to greater OPEC coordination and probably higher prices. On the other hand, there's always the retribution if there was a winner and if the conclusion was something other than a ceasefire. Then, in fact, you might see the floodgates open as each side attempted to recoup attempt to acquire the revenues to rebuild their war-torn economies. So I think that it's really not clear which effect dominates.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on the low and medium and high scenarios, and I appreciate the way that the assumptions are laid out so we can cross-check them against what happens in the news. But if you were to compare these three scenarios to what we used to do with the 30th and 50th and 70th percentile, the way we used to work, are these in general, is it just a general statement, a wider range of scenarios? I mean, is the high higher than it used to be and the low lower than the old 30th percentile? Are they narrower or where do they fall?
Yes. In fact, the low is lower and the high is higher. Yes, that would be correct.
Is it? Would it be possible to try to give some kind of a probability of what maybe the low represents? I mean, is it only 20% chance or 10%?
Right. We have, we did weight, the price group weighted the scenarios. And I can tell you that in a rough way, that the low scenario is like essentially the 20% case. The mid is about the 60, and the high is roughly the 90 percentile. Then that would be the weights assigned by the price group.
Okay, so the mid is not the 50th percentile. The mid has less than a 50-50 chance of being achieved.
Yes, and that's because as a group, the participants in putting together the price scenarios are pretty consistent. They're bears. They were very much bearish, and in fact, put a much larger weight on the low scenario than they did on the high, with the result that the average comes in, somewhat below. In other words, the middle case is 60 instead of 50%.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thank you, too. At this time, I'm going to call up Jay Hogan, please. We're going to go through the summary of revenues versus appropriations.
Marla.
Would you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, Jay Hogan, Director of Budget Review. I believe the committee has a single-page handout that we provided labeled Summary of Revenues and Appropriations. If I might, I'd start with the back rather than the front by simply calling to the committee's attention the items that we treat differently in our summary from a similar summary prepared by the staff of the committee. So basically, our areas of difference, and this is really the essence of this.
Once Hogan gets done with his summary, I'd like to give you a briefing on the House Finances summary, how we see it at this particular time. We're going to eliminate some of the items that the administration has placed before the public here, and I'll go over the House Finances summary as we see it at this particular time. Mr. Hogan.
But basically, the significant difference for the purposes of discussion of revenues is that we have included at the governor's request, in addition to the Rail Belt Energy Fund, the 89 assumption mid-case, assuming that the ELF formula revision were to pass. So also, then reverting to the more detailed chart on the front, we have not assumed the outcome for the purposes of this chart of the governor's action on Senate Bill 330. We have shown those numbers in the appropriation stream as they were introduced by the governor. For example, school debt at 102. We have nothing on this for the mental health requests. The governor has not had a chance to review those yet or come up with a recommended series of appropriations there. The committee has suggested consideration of the request and shown the value of the request. I think that's basically the significant difference. I think what I would like to add is that basically the governor is still concerned, as he was last fall and as he was in January, with the general economic situation throughout the state. And it's his feeling that these are doable and arguably usable revenue sources that he has suggested. They are not the only revenue sources, additional revenue sources. But he is of the opinion that we simply need to address the question of additional revenue sources at this time. And these are his two candidates.
Representative Pourchaud, we're looking at the summary of revenues and appropriations from the Division of Budget.
Yeah, just skipping over the backup funding sources, which is a whole other discussion and debate for a second. I have a question on your number 7, Jobs Bill, Chapter 10, 75.2, and then other, 55.9. I'm not familiar with that figure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pourchaud, when the bill is introduced, we did include a $150 million item. 75 of that is incorporated in the jobs bill. 20 million is basically included in the budget amendments that we netted out of that sum, leaving in the governor's bill as introduced, leaving the 55 million as yet unspecifically spoken for. So we simply continued that the existence of that number.
Chairman, I'm not sure I follow that logic. Do you have something specific in mind?
At this time, there's nothing introduced. Again, what we did, Mr. Chairman, here was list the values of everything that we have formally introduced to the legislature. And in the case of the general fund budget amendments that were introduced last week, we, for our own internal purposes of keeping track of what the governor was proposing, netted them out of the other $75 million that had originally been proposed for jobs bill projects.
So if we scratch that line, I mean, that would save another $55 million, right?
At this time, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Representative Rinkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one question, and I don't want to get into the backup funding sources question per se, but I'm just wondering, if you look at the mid-price scenario, I'm looking ahead to fiscal year 1990. Yeah. It looks like 1990 is only about $50 million more in annual revenue than 1989. And I'm wondering, with the increases that the governor has proposed, you know, you take the 1856 for the operating budget, would that level of spending be sustainable in 1990, fiscal 1990, even if you passed all these backup funding sources that you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rieger, at this point, that's a little hard to project. Using the current projection, it would appear not, but one, going back again to the beginning of our budget process, the governor wanted this year to be a breather in the potential further reductions of the operating budget. And he wanted this year to be a breather because of the general state of the economy. So I would assume that plan is still intact and would lead to some continued effort to reduce the budget to achieve a greater degree of balance between the then, assuming these revenue sources were to pass, the then available general fund recurring revenues as opposed to expenditures. But again, I would caution that I have been myself somewhat confused listening to the various oil price experts in the last 10 days from various points around the nation on the various cable stations, each with their idea of what's going to happen. And what strikes me is the remarkable degree of inability to come to a central conclusion. They run from the prices are going to go up more than we have estimated to the fact that they're going to go down more. So I have difficulty enough dealing with the current revenue forecast, let alone what might come up in 1990, in the 1990 budget.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I have another question, but I'd just point out that this year, that middle column, the mid-price scenario, is, as I just heard a minute ago, the 60th percentile. It's not even a half, not even a 50-50 chance of it being achieved. And there's a tremendous amount of growth in the budget, which is funded out of one-time monies in this spending plan, Rail Belt Energy Fund. And using that 60th percentile forecast, as unlikely as it might be, to the next year, it looks like this spending plan is not even sustainable for a second year, even if there was no growth in the next year. I mean, I think we're setting ourselves up for inevitable cuts the very next year. And that's even if these revenue increases that are proposed in here are passed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One of the things I'd like members to look at is the general funds available for appropriations that the House Chair has seen it. You can go and look at the low revenue estimations, the medium, and also the high that has been stated today. I have injected the proposed budget by the governor. As you can see, the numbers, if you're starting with the in the top portion, FY88 expenditures, you can see that showing us that we have a carry forward on each place of 2.261.4. Our carry forward balances are different between low, medium, and high. And this, once we get down to the spending plan, this is where the administration and the House Finance disagree, because in their particular spending plan, they have put $55.9 million into a jobs bill, which they see they'd like to see come forward. I don't have that in our particular spending plan. Neither does the House Finance at this particular point have the Rail Belt Energy Fund of $238.9 million as an expenditure and the ELF formula at this particular time. But if you go down to look at it, I have put in what the revenue estimates could be at 1458 and in the medium and also the low. But if you're going on proposed FY89 expenditures, and this has not been passed by the House caucus yet, it shows you of 1.844.3 for the operating budget, and each of us must realize that includes the $23 million that has been injected in for the education part. That particular bill is supposed to be signed by this particular Friday, if we can find the governor. Is he out of state at this time, Mr. Holden?
He is out of state at
Thank
this time.
You. But that should that particular bill is supposed to be in state by Friday to be signed or vetoed or what have you. The also the school debt service of 117.7 is the one that was passed by this particular body. It is increased by $15 million where the governor's level of $102 million. And you can see the general debt service, other debt service, the capital, which will be debated here shortly, the loans programs, new legislation is what we expect to pass in fiscal notes, this particular $10 million. Now, the other ones that you see, the budget amendments, as in the child legislation, those, I've just cranked these numbers in to show you also the mental health request and the operating capital. They are not completely supported by any caucus, but I needed to show what the bottom line would have. And it shows, any way you look at it, that you're going to have a negative balance there, and you need to look at a backup plan. And my first backup plan, as I've told you before, is the ELF. The ELF bill is the one that I think before you look at either the rail belt or the permanent fund earnings. And these are basically the difference that we have between the administration and the House's proposed format. Representative Larson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is in relation to the backup sources, too. I know last year at this time we were looking at the earnings reserve to the budget reserve to whatever. In the administration's proposal this year, I noticed that that is left out. Could you just tell us a little bit I'm not advocating it. I'm just asking here what went into your thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, I think the governor would be perfectly amenable to language that would make either, basically, his candidate would be the Railroad Energy, so let me discuss that one. I don't think he would object at all if language were written that made it clear that, assuming the passage of the ELF formula revision, that if the mid-case were to occur and we were to appropriate relatively as either the governor's or the House scenarios suggest, and we were in fact to end up with the 160 surplus, that there would be no need to transfer that money out of the Rail Belt Energy Fund or borrow from it or whatever. So I think he would be amenable to language like that. And I know this was discussed for a variety of sources last year, and he didn't really have a particular objection to that. There's no need to move money out of the Rail Belt Energy Fund or permanent fund earnings if that were to be a backup, if it's not needed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I guess my question was more related to the two backup funding sources, the Rail Belt Energy Fund or the ELF. We oftentimes hear of the third being the earnings reserve.
Yeah.
And I see that that is not mentioned, and I was just wondering if the, I'm trying to think of the right word here, what was being advocated last year and what is being advocated this year is a change in the administration's policy.
A slight change, Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson. I think the governor's preference is really zeroed in on both of these two sources in preference to permanent fund earnings. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The governor's proposal, or as we see it here, does not include any money for the Science Foundation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that was to be a permanent fund appropriation.
So you do envision it coming
down? What we're doing here is just confining it to the regular general fund appropriation.
I wanted to make sure we were still on the same track with that one.
Representative Gull.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, one question. In relation to the point that Representative Rieger was making, if I understood it correctly, it would seem to me that even at this mid-price, which incidentally I think is an unfortunate choice of words, if it has less than a 50-50 chance of being valid, I think it's somewhat misleading to the public. But at any rate, even at this mid-price, it uses these Rail Belt Energy Funds, which I would personally support using for capital, insofar as those are one-time only expenditures, but it does create the assumption of significant budget cuts in FY90 in the operating budget if it's used as shown here. Other than the legislation which the governor has already indicated his support of in terms of revenues, do you have any other way of resolving that apparent problem that's going to come up next year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gall, I think the governor's feeling is that as future years come upon us, that we will need to more closely examine, perhaps than we have, additional revenue sources, or if they are not acceptable, continue the budget reduction exercise down to a level that is supportable.
I think
that's exactly what
budget exercise in FY90 you're referring to.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess my concern then in the short term is with FY89. I would speculate that it's going to be difficult to achieve the revenue goals set out in your document. And for that reason, I tend to feel that the House's summary reflects the facts better. I'm, of course, troubled to see the high estimate even being there. Estimate with a 10% probability hardly seems worth putting out before the public. No matter how you look at it, it appears that we're coming towards a deficit situation. I know that's not the bottom line in your document, but it certainly is the bottom line in on the street. And I was just wondering if you had a policy to express to this body in this sense. We have the opportunity of giving the governor a deficit budget and then putting the pressure on him essentially to veto it down to a level that is supported by revenues. But I prefer to see it be a cooperative process, and the only way I know to do that is to get a real clear sense of priorities. And I've not been successful over the years in suggesting that we should concentrate on the constitutional obligations of this state and let all the discretionary programs essentially fight it out for place. Rather, what we do, and this has been consistent, at least in my limited 6 years of experience, has been to put both priority, you know, non-discretionary, constitutionally mandated programs like public health and public safety together with discretionary programs that have failed to show an impact on the state, such as many of the activities of the Department of Commerce. I don't see them being prioritized. I don't see the basic gut needs of the people of this state being protected while the discretionary programs, certainly popular to many, many groups, are put in a second position. Do you feel that the administration might, given the tremendous pressure that is being generated here by the fervor to support worthy programs, combined with the clear statement that we don't have enough money to support those programs, do you see any new initiative out of the administration that would direct this legislature to prioritize spending according to the Constitution and not just along the lines provided by the original budget of the administration? In other words, do you see any chance of an initiative from the administration to say, hey, sure, we funded all of that at that level, but these are where the cuts ought to be targeted, not these are where the increases should come, but this is where we think you should cut. Could we hope for any such dialogue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gall, basically at this time, it's my sense that the governor really wants to stand by his budget as presented in January and modified somewhat a week or so ago. And the reason for that is he is convinced that this is a difficult economic time for Alaska. We've got numerous articles and papers and ICER reports and so on that talk about the relation between our level of government spending and the declining economy. Some argument about whether one preceded the other, but nonetheless, they're in tandem. He's concerned that if we propose dropping below the levels that he has suggested, that we'll simply continue or refuel that decline situation. He's really not desirous of doing that. He also thinks that we simply have to begin, and I think this gets at your prioritization question, we have to begin to look at more normal ways for paying for government service, which we have, through a great stroke of fortune, been able to avoid for the last 10 or 12 years. As a first step to that, his first choice, for instance, since the beginning of the session, was to suggest that the Rail Belt Energy Fund be used. Why? He's not convinced there's any real purpose for it, not in the same vein under which the fund was established. And that's why that was his first selection. Secondly, he feels that some years ago, when the ELF factor was adjusted, that it was not the majority intention to create the situation in which we currently find ourselves. And he would simply like to see a restoration of that sense of balance that many people thought they were doing at the time, and that is that the marginal fields, marginal by Alaskan standards, the smaller producing areas, received the benefit of that program that was originally envisioned. So he thinks both of those areas are good first steps towards the exercise of having to generate revenues in order to support a budget. This exercise will begin to force everyone to deal with the budget exactly the way you suggest, not necessarily selecting out constitutional items, but will force people to weigh the price of raising this revenue from this source against the cost of providing the service and the public reaction to it. There are obviously other choices, all of which he has introduced legislation on: gas tax increase, income tax, the whole host of bills that are basically left from last year. I don't think there's any question but what the state will have to consider each and every one of those items in, if not this session, the next session beyond that. But at this time, he thinks these are the two to focus on. He doesn't know what Railroad Energy Fund is supposed to do, and neither do I. The ELF formula revision seems a fair and equitable restatement, if you will, of what many of us thought we were doing half a dozen years ago. So that's simply his choice of where to start, and it's not his plan at this time to reprioritize, if you will, the budget downward.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, I sympathize with the predicament that the administration is in, and in a sense less so than with our own, because we certainly have the responsibility, as I've been asking you to take as well, to reduce those areas that are less important and support those areas that are more important. I'm just sort of finding a kind of uncomfortable situation, and I'll summarize it briefly and ask you to take the lead or join with us in taking the lead in resolving it. And that is that on the floors of this building today are people seeking support for very, very important programs. We've seen the desire to support programs for developmentally disabled, which have been cut below the level that's appropriate. We've seen the need to restore funding for vital children's programs in safety and health that are essential. We've also seen, possibly in some of those lists, support for components that are less essential, and I don't really see a lot of deep scrutiny being given at this time, at least to the extent that it's risen to the surface, of where those dollars exactly should be targeted, either, let's just say at this point, by the administration, because the subcommittee work is ongoing. What I see is happening, though, because of a lack of specific prioritization of this difficult set of choices, is that those of us who feel, for example, in Southeast, that without a decent surface transportation system, without adequate funds to provide the infrastructure for the ferries, all the economic development initiatives that are so glowingly touted in certain departments really come to very little. And so what kind of strategy do we have to adopt? Well, in children's and disabled programs, we have to try to raise those levels as high as possible. I have to try to raise the level on ferry funding as high as possible. But what is the reality we're putting out there, or even before? Because while we're padding, we're not addressing the central issue of what we can pay for. And the only thing I can see is that we better take a careful look at those programs that are less essential, because unless you are successful as an administration in getting the other body to act on language already passed by this body, then the crisis is simply going to come. And why not? I guess what I'm trying to do is just throw back to the administration the respectful suggestion that rather than avoiding direct involvement in these difficult decisions now, I'd like to see some fallback positions developed by the administration so that we don't go out of here with essentially a bogus budget and stick the governor with the responsibility of making difficult cuts on his own, when in fact there are a lot of people willing to participate in going through the budget in depth and saying, look, you know, this is the time to trim in certain areas. I've spoken longer than I intended to. I just feel that correcting this problem by adding to the vital programs only to see vetoes down the road is not only a waste of an exercise, but also creates a false impression in the public that in fact programs are going to be increased. And I would like to feel that that the leadership that is being exerted as you seek those increases in your budget amendments would also be exerted so that we find where we're going to pay for those. And I'm afraid that some of that is going to have to come out of other programs. I've never seen that be a very successful effort in the past, because everybody wishes to protect themselves from the political downside of making cuts. But we're here to take that sort of heat, and so is the administration. And I would like, if I could, once again, to respectfully encourage you to move to the next level of dialogue now and begin to talk about what we're going to do if you don't get the Rail Belt Energy Fund for operating programs. Because, you know, if you don't solve it this year, you're going to have to solve it next year.
Mr. Chairman, we of course, stand ready to cooperate in any sort of a review or prioritization exercise. However, one must look at the problem from the governor's perspective. If he, recognizing that out of the entire $2.2 billion budget, there will be items about which the governor and the legislature disagree. That's inevitable. It happens every year. There will always be adjustments to a budget where the legislature will, in fact, reprioritize to some degree administrative recommendations. We would, of course, be involved in that as we always have been and try to work out reasonable compromises. However, if the governor believes the level of spending, as he does, is in the best interest of the state at this time, and if he believes that these two additional revenue sources are available, are obtainable with the requisite amount of attention and effort and public support focused on it, then he really has no choice but to go forward based on that series of assumptions. To do otherwise would work against his goal of seeing these two sources basically used.
Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If, Mr. Hogan, if we don't pass the ELF repeal and if we don't provide a direct appropriation for use of the Rail Belt Energy Funds, and we do place language in the budget that suggests that if cash flow is insufficient to meet the operating needs of state government, that you could say, tap into either the Rail Belt Energy Fund or the Earnings Reserve Account, do we have sufficient cash flow to get us from here to there, get us from here to January, so that the legislature would have the opportunity to address these other revenue sources if we don't address them this year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, I really don't know the answer to that right now. We could certainly, it's a little difficult to run a cash flow analysis at this time, but I would certainly ask revenue to do that. I don't know the answer at this time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that, I mean, it seems to me that that's a critical thing for all of us to know. If we're, you know, if we have a paper deficit absent the passage of something like one of these alternatives, but we're cash flush, that's different than being cash poor as well as having a paper deficit, and that would force us to make different decisions regardless of which body you sit in. So I'd appreciate it if you haven't gotten that together, that we could see that very soon. But also the discussion about whether or not we have the revenues in FY 80 or FY 90 or 91 or certainly time into the future is all speculation. And since we're speculating, how about speculating with regard to the back taxes issue, the $2.5 to $3.5 billion outstanding that even at a 10% payout in year 90 or 91 or 92 begins to fill a huge gap in our funding shortfall in the nature of $250 to $350, maybe even as much as $400 million a year. And could you speculate with us for a moment on how you see that fitting into the futures picture?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, the very first one would be right up there at the top of the list. That is only a small portion of the Dinkum Sands payment. That is the worst case scenario outcome that the state would experience under the eventual settlement of that. I've tended not to speculate on those subjects because it's the reverse of speculating on oil prices or similar to speculating on oil prices. But it's clear that this state has a very unusual series of possibilities that other states simply lack. There are disputed tax cases, there are disputed land situations, there are disputed tariff situations, all of them in substantial dollar amounts as to potential value. The questions are, with all of them, when and how much. But it's clear that if you were looking at the next 5 years, you'd be quite right. Some of those would be, in all likelihood, coming due within the next 5 years. The difficulty is trying to guess whether it would give assistance in 1990, but it's clear that there are many hundreds of millions of dollars of potential settlement that would be anticipated to occur sometime in the next 5 years.
Representative
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't call them settlements necessarily in every case, but with respect to the back taxes issue, we've got an aggressive policy being undertaken by the Department of Revenue and the administration, contrary to rhetoric surrounding legislation in the other body, to the contrary, that is seeking to resolve that issue, and that is not through a settlement mechanism. And I would hope that we as a group in the House and certainly in the Senate as well would allow the administration the latitude and the budgetary ability to continue to pursue those back taxes, because I see them clearly as a way to soften the blow of the early 90s, the drop in the price of oil or and certainly the field decline. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last question. Mr. Hogan, I know said something to the effect that, I hope I don't misquote, but something to the effect the governor is convinced that we have to go to more normal ways of paying for government services. And I know that beyond what's on this list, as you mentioned, the governor has proposed going into the personal income tax and the earnings of the permanent fund or whatever else. At this higher level of spending that's proposed, next year, looking to FY90, have you had discussions? Do you know, is the governor going to propose, or would you expect him to propose that we go to the personal income tax or one of the others rather than cut government at that time?
Mr. Chairman, we have had no such discussions. I would assume that that would occur early in the summer.
Okay.
But I'm not aware of any such planning at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No further questions? Thank you, sir, for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. We only have one bill up this afternoon, and that's House Bill number 523. We'll just wait a couple of minutes here, Representative Frank, on your, is this your bill?
And we just move it out, Mr. Chairman?
Get ourselves into the same situation we're in now by spending at a level that can't be sustained.
Real fast, we've got House Bill 2523, an act relating to preference of recycled products in state, municipal, and school district procurement. This is sponsored by Representative Frank and Menard. This has a zero fiscal note. This particular bill would give procurement preference to the purchase of Alaska recycled products when these products are of comparable value and appropriate for use. The bill directs the Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development to adopt regulations, establish whether a product qualifies as a recycled product, and publish this information. Recycled products are defined as having at least 50% of their product value consisting of products previously used in another product if the recycling process was done in Alaska. The bill extends the recycle preference to municipalities and municipal school districts. There is no fiscal impact on this bill. The prime sponsor of this bill is Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, you've done an excellent job of describing the bill. The bill genesis comes out of a situation in Fairbanks where the municipal or our borough has turned over and contracted with a recycler to take over the dump and recycle the garbage. And they've increased employment there from, I think, 6 to 22 people. They're producing fuel pellets now and expect to be producing plastic products comparable to wood products in the future. The idea is to give them some statutory recognition for state procurement. They're probably already covered by state procurement preference, but also to extend the requirement for municipalities and school districts as they are primary purchasers of they're some of the biggest purchasers of products in the state. So we felt that by requiring the municipalities and the school districts to purchase recycled products, it would give them a start on enhancing this industry all over the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would attempt to answer any questions that members may have.
Any questions? No questions. Representative Gull?
Ready for a motion.
No, I've got people that might want to testify. Representative Larson, you have questions?
Just a general one. I'm trying to stall.
Okay.
We're waiting for a call back from the manager of the city of Palmer, but in relation to that, on page 1, line 13 and 14, it says, in this section, school districts do not include regional attendance areas or the REAAs. Is there some reason for it?
Mr. Chairman, I think the reason, I have, in my own mind, I had a concern about subjecting a small municipality or a small school district to a burdensome procurement requirement. And I was toying with the idea of whether we should make it just large municipalities, municipalities under, you know, or over 10,000 or 5,000 or something like that. And so this was a somewhat arbitrary decision to affect the larger school districts and municipalities and not necessarily...
My only concern, was that within REAs, we have a lot of small little city school districts, too, and should not they be exempt as well as the REAs?
That's probably a valid consideration. I certainly don't have any objection to that, and if that's the will of the body, I certainly don't have any objection to that whatsoever. I think what we're trying to do is get the larger municipalities and larger purchasing entities to start thinking about recycled products and encourage that development of recycling. Now, recycling is very viable all throughout the state, I think, according to the recycler in Fairbanks. His hope is that all the coastal communities would have a baler and be able to bail up their municipal waste, segregate it and bail it, and then ship it off to a recycler where it could be recycled. And it sounds like it's got great possibilities, even for the small communities, too.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Representative Rieger.
Just one question. What are the procurement preferences under this code? What's the percentage?
It would amount to, essentially, they would qualify for a 7% preference, so that if they were less than, they'd get a 7% preference.
Same as we passed 2 years ago.
Yes, for the state.
Yeah.
It would extend that product preference, that percentage, to the municipalities and school districts.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. Does this apply to procurements of the state itself? Or
yes.
It does. So the state would also be required to purchase recycled products?
Yes. In fact, it's I can as much as say that it is currently required, but we're just statutorily outlining it so that a recycler can point to that when it goes to a bank and tries to get financing. Because the most difficult part in financing this recycling, these efforts, is evidently trying to get somebody to believe you can sell your product. And this will hopefully help in that regard.
Other questions? Does anybody else want to testify? What's the pleasure of the committee? Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we report out CS for House Bill 523 with individual recommendations.
Is there any objections?
I would object. If I could have 60 seconds, and if I'm not back in 60 seconds, I'll remove my objection, okay?
Yes, we'll take 60 seconds of these.
Mr. Chairman, on that subject, we are admittedly, the concept of putting in the municipalities is a late-breaking concept, and I've checked with my city and my borough and both gotten positive indications from both those entities, at least from the executives of both. And we have also talked to Scott Burgess with the Municipal League, and his general position was that they weren't probably crazy about the idea, but probably and generally opposed situations where the state dictated to the municipalities, but they haven't come back yet, really had a chance to come back yet with a position paper on it.
Yes.
While we're waiting in recess here, have you given any thought to the timing of the closeout of the subcommittee work? Or
yes. Right after next week is what I'm going to do is go to the caucus with caps on each of the budgets, and then the closeouts will start following our Easter break.
Thank you.
With a brief statement, I would remove my objection. The objection that we had from the city manager, Palmer, was that he felt it didn't go far enough. He thought anyone who got state money should be held responsible to what's provided for here. And I tend to agree with him, but maybe that's another subject for another day. So that, I remove my objection.
Hearing no objection, this bill is moved out of committee. That completes our...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for...
Standing report, please.